Hello all, this is Nina and we are gathered up for the Audible Weed Walk episode number 25. It has been raining, you know, it has been raining since before the 24th of November. We have found many vocabularies of rain, you know, it's time to catch up with all that, you know, mizzling, drizzling, raining, pouring, cats and dogs. But it looks like we'll rain straight into the summer, as it is getting warmer also. Have you felt? This is unusual, folks. Apparently, we have not received so much rain in this part of the country, in Tamil Nadu, from the northeast or retrieving monsoon in January in almost over 100 years. Whether we take it as an incident which is a cyclical phenomena, a normal thing, or a clear evidence of climate change that definitely predicts erratic weather condition and increasing number of erratic weather events. The fact remains, growing anything predictably is difficult. There is, however, a large growth of greens, both cultivated and, of course, a lot of uncultivated ones. Even when the rain stops and we give our customary a few days of gap, we will have plenty of greens and new sprouts to forage on. Notice there is a sense of well-being there. But what about people who do not have access to even balcony to grow food? How about people who have plenty of space but no awareness about what seasonal local food to eat? And about the wild edibles that nourish us? What if they are actually looking at these wild, uncultivated, weedy growths and thinking, oh my God, when will I have the time to clear that up? Coupled with that, consider these anecdotes. I shared my donation campaign widely. Since Oroville International USA is the primary host for receiving the donations, I have particularly requested my friends and family in the USA to circulate and request in their network. A friend confirmed that she has shared widely, and while sharing, she has made a wish that initiatives like mine are more common, drawing attention to the uncultivated wild greens, having coloring book that can engage children and adult both, and children can be included in exploring the wilderness and foraging. She thinks that it will increase their intake of greens. Currently, it is pitifully low. Now, I had friends who had ensured when their kids were very young that they would eat their plate of salad to qualify for something they desired, like, you know, a cheesy pizza or a dessert. But this was a bit common for me. But in reality, that is quite uncommon. Even in the example I had given, the kids have to be very clearly given incentives and disincentives in order to actually eat the greens. There are exceptions, of course. I remember being an extremely picky eater myself, causing much trouble at home. But amidst all of that, I was really fond of spinach, peas, and pointed gourds. The consistency of fresh, frozen, or canned, and how differently a single green is cooked make a whole lot of difference in the palatability, especially for kids. Connecting with nature via food seems most obvious and easy. Think again. I have been asked during the weed walk I conduct, identifying some from the set of 40 wild weedy greens that are in my edible weed coloring book, if it would be really healthy to eat something that actually grows touching the dirt. In case you are unaware, some people call soil dirt. In 90s, I think there was a survey of school children in the USA by National Geographic, and kids had associated chicken to drumsticks of chicken and milk to bottles. Such was our disconnect. But children, most of them, like playing and exploring. Do they connect better with the greens and eat them if somehow they're involved? I had spent a summer in El Dorado Spring in Missouri. Well, this is really a place in the middle of nowhere, a small town. Well, I could write a book about that summer. This was when I had already started living in Oroville. I was very interested in extending the vegetable growing window to a little bit, but to do it sustainably and organically. I had found this nascent institute in this small town in Missouri, really quite unique. They were, exploring low-cost hydroponic growing that suited tropical countries, where greenhouses and high techs are not involved. In fact, they had projects in USA, Bolivia, Cuba to grow food in poor communities and with the community effort to end hunger. They would also teach children how to grow food in schools to increase their kind of relation with greens. And they had found that children who, due to poverty or due to peer pressure or simply by choice, did not want to eat any green vegetables at all, willingly ate them when they were involved in either growing them or picking them. That set me thinking, are these examples of involving children in foraging wild, uncultivated greens also? I had some time back read an article in New York Times, I think it was in New York Times, that talked about that among the Mardu people in Australia, children are adept hunter-gatherers by the time they are just 5 to 6 years old. This is so linked to our concept of childhood. In some cultures, 18 is where children leave home and a sort of passage to adulthood. In others, irrespective of how old you are, they remain children as long as people from their older generation are present and active. Think about it. In old news and literature, you find 14, 15 years old are being considered an adult. And now we think 22, 24 years old are juvenile, they're adolescent, and sometimes extending the definition of young to 30 or 40 years old. Well, why not? We live in a community where we uphold the youth that never ages, the child in each one of us. But there I clearly digressed. Let me get back to children and foraging wild edibles. Paper in a journal article by American Psychological Association on Environment and Behavior, the author studied childhood foraging as a means of acquiring competent human cognition about biodiversity. And this particular study concluded that persons who forage more wild varieties in their childhood have better sense of biodiversity as adult. Isn't that amazing? So all we need to do to create, greater policymakers, planners, architects, and conservationists is to let them forage their food when they're young and forage from the wild uncultivated greens. That's simple. And they're growing like weeds all over around us. Then in my exploration, suddenly in my social media page, I saw a photo. This was posted by a farmer from Bangladesh. He posted the photo of his 5-year-old son holding a bunch of wild greens, a variety of them actually. These are all weeds. Some of them, many of them are actually in my book. That's what actually caught my attention. This little fellow had collected them on his way back home from school. Something very usual. So he just, happened to just post this photograph. A lush bunch of green he foraged. That would be incorporated in the lunch because, he's a 5-year-old. So he goes to school and returns pretty early. So by the time he returns and he has this set of greens, it is incorporated in lunch and which he is going to willingly eat. Turned out all across India, even in Tamil Nadu, perhaps 1 or 2 generations back, that was the practice. Little kids would enjoy foraging and pick seasonal greens on their way back home from school. not always as a compulsion or economic reasons, but also as part of game, as a joyful engagement, a play that kids indulged in before illuminated screens got all our attention. I remember reading something similar from a while ago when I was exploring a list of 14 greens eaten in Bengal ceremoniously on a particular day of the year to resume eating greens, especially the wild greens, after the southwest monsoon stops. And, of course, a bit of customary rest after that. Someone from Sundarbans was reminiscing about his childhood when he and his friends, during the season, were designated to pick these varieties of greens and bring home for this festival. I have found a book on childhood foraging that reports about a workshop sponsored by the U.S. National Institute of Child Health and Human Development that had brought together 27 scholars in 2002. The paper that came out of this exercise suggested that hunter-gatherer way of life is a major interest to the anthropologists because dependence on wild food resources was the way human acquired food for the vast majority of their history. It seems children in hunter-gathering societies generally have fewer chores assigned to them because, there are not that much to do around at home, like subsistence work or babysitting, tending, compared to the other societies, the settled societies. This means the kids have more time to play and explore their environment. But play does not mean that the children are not learning about subsistence. In fact, much of their play involves playing what the adults do, like hunt with mini bows and arrows, or go collectively to gather and cook. In some hunter-gatherer groups, a lot of real work goes on in these activities. For example, there's a paper by Crittenden and colleagues written in 2013 that had reported that among the Hadza, a particular community in Tanzania, children 5 years of age or younger may be getting half the food that they eat on their own. By the time they are, 6 to 7 years old, 75% of the food that they actually eat that they themselves gather, which means they also actually bring some for their families too. Imagine that. By the way, for the rest of the podcast, I'll change a gear a little. Tuesday, 12 January, was the birth anniversary of Swami Vivekananda. I cannot complete this podcast without a belated tribute to this amazing foodie sannyasi. He apparently, as a child, had formed a foodie kind of club. And later in his life, he even explored and created a khichdi or a fried rice sort of things, being influenced by the French cuisine. Sister Nivedita, one of his very famous disciples, had elaborated, documented his culinary skills and recipes. He could cook dishes from different nations, and needless to say, most of them were involved all kinds of varieties of food, both vegetarian and non-vegetarian. While cooking the famous French pea soup, that was his favorite dish, he wanted to add chunk of fish to make it more delicious. Sarala Devi Chaudhary, in her memoir, had written that Swamiji invited her to Belur Math and cooked dishes from Norway, from Kashmir, from France, from USA. And the day he left the world, he fed his fellow disciples his favorite Hilsa fish, which he himself actually overseen the cooking. So it's often compared to the Jesus' Last Supper. And so how could you not honor such a, person whose birthday had just we had just celebrated a few days back? Okay, so I think we will explore more about edible wild greens and different aspects of it next time. So take care and see you next time.
This is Oroville Radio.